Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. Hooray for Argentina. And we're all glad that Macron has had to go home unhappy. Well, most of us are glad. So on the show today, we're going to be talking about a number of matters, but we want to begin by covering the labor front. And we do that with Tony Leah of Unifor. And Tony is both a scholar and an activist. He's a member of Local 222, retired, and I believe still the president of the Political Action Committee. Are you there, Tony?
I am, Phil.
We're very glad to be talking to you because a lot of interesting developments in labor. There's been very important struggles on university campuses in Canada. I think they have a contract issue outstanding at the University of Toronto. I know that McMaster University had settled with the education workers there, the research and teaching assistants. And since we were following that, my eyes moved over to stateside and discovered there was a very large labor action by University of California workers, and pretty striking. And I know you looked into it. So what has happened there? By the way, it involves your old cousins, United Auto Workers.
It is the United Auto Workers and a lot of academic workers, teaching assistants, research assistants. I'm not sure what the reason is, but a lot of them are now members of the UAW. And I guess once some have decided to join, then it makes sense for others to join. And they form a very important segment of the UAW now. I think that's something more than 40,000 members. It might be significantly more than that. They're a big chunk of the UAW membership now. At the University of California, they were negotiating for about 9 months to try to substantially increase their wages and win other benefits. And after 9 months of negotiations, they went on strike, and they were on strike for 5 weeks. And it was a very militant, engaged strike. They had their members picketing, carrying out occupations, all kinds of activities on different campuses.
Did you say occupations?
Yeah.
Such as, what did they do?
Well, I'll just read a brief description from the New York Times, which I think captures a lot of it. Workers walked off the job on November 14th. They pressured the university with campus rallies and sit-ins. They had support from hundreds of faculty members who pledged not to cross picket lines. They occupied the chancellor's office at UC Berkeley, blocked parking facilities at UC Santa Barbara, demonstrated outside the offices and homes of university donors and regents in Orange County and San Diego, rallied outside the state capitol in Sacramento. Sit-in protesters were arrested at the UC office of the president in Sacramento and at the headquarters of the David Geffen Company, which is helmed by Richard Sherman, a UC regent. And they had a rally featuring the guitarist of Rage Against the Machine outside the UCLA Luskin Center. And then they marched into a meeting where the Board of Regents was deciding whether or not they should be allowed to join the Big Ten, their academic athletic teams. And they delayed the decision for hours as they chanted, "Shut it down." So that's just some of the activities they carried out over the course of a 5 week strike.
Was it? That is impressive. And how did they do?
They ended up with what it looks to me from the outside as a very remarkable tentative agreement. They're still voting on it. So we don't have the final results as we speak. But they achieved for the lowest paid workers in this group, and there was 48,000, remember, 48,000 workers we're talking about. The lowest paid of them will get an increase of 55% over the next 2.5 years.
Over 3.5?
55% in 2.5 years.
In 2.5 years.
55%. In 2.5 years. And then they get more increases after that, but it's front loaded. Most of the increases are at the beginning of the contract. They won increases in allowances for childcare and a number of other benefits to make life more livable for those people who are trying to be students and spending half their time as well doing a lot of the heavy lifting of the work that's done on campus.
Mm-hmm. By the way, this is not the first contract. They've been there and organized.
Yes.
So that is really significant. 55%.
It's huge.
Huge. Usually you get locked into kind of a incremental gain. But that doesn't sound incremental to me. That's like a
no.
breakthrough.
No, and it's fantastic. They obviously have an engaged membership. I don't know what organizing they did prior to, but I would have to believe they did a lot of organizing to get their members to this point where they could carry out a strike like that. And they've achieved something that I think will inspire a lot of people, other academic workers, but workers in general. Mm-hmm. We know that when workers make gains, when unions make gains, that's when it gets exciting for other workers to say, hey, that's what we need to do.
Yeah, I hope that the guys at McMaster will hear about this.
yeah.
And University of Toronto and elsewhere.
I want to mention something else. So because you mentioned that they are UAW members, this group of academic workers played a very big role in the referendum on whether or not the UAW would move to one member, one vote. The academic sections of the UAW voted 90%, 95% in favor of one member, one vote.
Yeah, it shows they use the Berkeley Library. It's funny. I use that term. Everybody sort of says, oh, Berkeley, that's like saying Paris Commune. But actually, it's 10 campuses. And,
yes.
And it's 38,000. That's quite a number.
Yeah, the University of California has 300,000 students.
Hmm. Yeah, they're big. And this is a big part of the reason that the campus is able to function. Without them, everything would pretty much come to an end, right?
Yep. Yep.
Well, tell us, just remind everybody, you now have one member, one vote. That was a result of a fight with corruption, over corruption, in which some UAW bigwigs actually ended up in a brush with jail. I don't know if they're in jail, but...
Some of them are, yes.
And a very healthy debate leading to the decision to have one person, one vote. And we've had, I think we've spoken of it before, but I think it would be nice to repeat. Has that vote gone? And how does the UAW look now after the referendum?
It's going to be dramatically different, I believe. There's one final piece of the puzzle that hasn't been determined yet, and that is who's going to be the president. And that is a runoff between the incumbent, who's part of the existing administration caucus, Ray Curry, and the challenger, Sean Fain, who's part of the UAW Members United, that fought for one member, one vote, and has a much more progressive program for confronting and getting rid of two-tier systems and really making progress for workers. That vote hasn't been determined yet, but the administration only got about 40% of the vote in the first round. And I think it's hard to imagine that they will be able to increase that very much, but we won't know until the end of February, I believe, before the ballots are mailed out and returned and counted again. But in the meantime, of the positions that were decided in the first round, reformers won half of the spots on the National Executive Board, including one of the number two position, the National Secretary Treasurer, is one of the reformers. And a couple of the regional directors are reformers. So they stand, if they win the president as well, they'll have the top leadership and a majority of the executive board. So it's it looks very much like it could be real overturning of the system of control that's been in place in the UAW since the days of Walter Reuther. So, you know, we're going back 70 years.
Yes, you're the historian. So what Reuther had something in place that led to this kind of elite, I don't know the other word for it, a bureaucratic and elite system where it's awfully hard to do anything.
Impossible.
Awfully
hard. And in fact, it was impossible. Reuther called it the administration caucus. And what he established once he got control of the union in 1947, which was predicated on rallying people around an anti-communist platform. He said he was going to kick the communists out, and he did purge anybody that was even vaguely left-wing. And to maintain his control, he centralized power, and he established what was called the Administration Caucus, which was able to control who was elected to top leadership positions by using a system at conventions. The election system was by delegates to conventions, and they were able to use the staff of the union, who were all appointed by the international president, to rally their supporters at conventions and make sure that whoever they put forward would be the people who would be elected. And we've been familiar with that ever since, including in the Canadian section of the union. And it was carried on when the CAW split from the UAW, and it was carried on under Unifor. We saw that was part of the drama of the Jerry Dias affair, was Jerry trying to use that system to select Scott Doherty to be his replacement as president. That was all part of the same system that goes back to the Reuther days.
Mm-hmm. But now, but Canada, I mean, because it was an issue that really was dispiriting and troubling to Unifor members, the leadership has gone a change as a new leader, but they did not and have shown no interest in one person, one vote in Unifor.
No, there hasn't been the same history.
Did anybody try to raise that, by the way?
Fighting for that.
They had a convention. Did anybody try to get that on the floor, that subject?
There was a resolution from one Unifor local that proposed a one-member, one-vote system, but it did not get a lot of support at the convention. There hasn't been the same history on our side of the border of workers fighting for that. In the U.S., within the UAW, there's been a group of people fighting for that for going back 30 or 40 years. They never
probably started with Reuther, right? There were people did not like him. And by the way, you know, he used the red baiting, but he was after everybody who would challenge him, right?
Exactly. Yes. He wanted centralized control.
Yeah. Of course, it's also underreported. Here we are, CIUT, bless its heart, reaching, I hope, thousands of listeners and many labor people. But our media do not talk about this. There used to be at least a labor beat. There used to be a fellow at more than one at the Globe and Mail who would tell you what was going on with the labor movement in North America largely. But this story, to my knowledge, is not even the dramatic one of this contest for leader through this new system. I'm not aware of it being reported. I don't think, you know, usually these things become dramatic and you learn the names of the leaders. Like here, we know Dias and we knew heard about Doherty, and we're learning the new name of the your leader at Unifor. But we don't have a media that puts these faces and names in front of us so that we can get an orientation of what the labor movement is about and what its leaders are want. And I don't hate to put you on the spot, but what's the name of the, is it a woman who's leading the charge here that was going to trying to become president of UAW?
No, it's, there were a couple of women on the reform slate who have been elected to the executive board, but the candidate for president is a guy named Sean Fain.
Payne? P-A-Y-N? Fine?
Fain. I think it's, well, it's F-A-I-N.
Okay.
How it's pronounced, I could be pronouncing it incorrectly.
F-A-I-N, eh?
Yes.
Yeah, but the listeners will learn right along that my being dumb helps out, you see, because I have to repeat everything. So Mr. Fain, who didn't fight in vain, this is going to be fun.
It's very interesting. And you're right. I've seen almost no coverage in the mainstream media. I don't remember seeing a single story about this. I might have missed one somewhere, but it is a great lacking. We do get some labor coverage in our media, but it's what's happening in Canada.
Yes.
And
well, usually when the leaders are standing next to the prime minister, or next to the premier, they say
they're within the circle of
labor
light.
Leader. Yeah. Or next to a banker. Yeah. That's the labor leader.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's a disquieting thought. Well, now Unifor, we're almost coming up for the anniversary of the great stumble. Which was reported on the front page of the Globe and Mail, where great memorable headline. I think you can probably recite it. I can get the bag and the whatever, but I think you know the whole title. What was it the Globe reported?
Yeah, the bag of money and the bottle of cologne.
Yeah, a bag of money and a bottle of cologne. That was the title, right?
Yeah, that was at least part of the title, yeah.
That's going to go down as one of the more memorable titles. Certainly, I have to tell them, by the way, anybody interested in journalism, that's the kind of headline you want to write. Always be looking for the chance to say something like that. So long as there's content to the story, and unlike, you know, the yellow media, which just has headlines and no content. Well, the incident happened in, was it December? It was coming up to Christmas when the word got around that something had happened. Do we know when the cologne appeared on the table?
When the bag of money and the bottle of cologne were passed over?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was coming up to Christmas. The story didn't actually break until into February. Mm-hmm. And when Jerry found out that he was really going to be outed, and that Unifor had been put in the position, mainly by the Globe and Mail starting to write about the story, and he realized that more was going to come out, he tried to derail the investigation into him by taking an early retirement. And that was in the middle of March.
Yes.
And after that happened, the National Executive Board of Unifor met and laid charges against him. Or they may have laid the charges even before that, but we didn't know about it. And then he checked himself into rehab, reportedly, and they decided that they would put the required hearing into the charges against him on the shelf.
Uh-huh.
And it's been on the shelf since then. I mean, this is
nine
months ago.
We have dust and cobwebs. Well, weren't they? Yes. Usually there's also a sequence where you say, as I understand you're saying this, it was the executive laid the charge.
It was the National Executive Board that laid the charges against
Jerry
Dias a violation of the Constitution and
violation of the code
of ethics.
His day in court, as it were. He has to have, they had an opportunity, we assumed, to establish what happened.
Exactly. But that hearing should happen whether or not the accused chooses to appear. That's his choice, but it should proceed. And I am at a complete loss to understand why it has not been proceeded with, because I believe the members of Unifor would like to know more information about what happened and would like to see a resolution of the charges against their former president, who's been accused of very serious wrongdoing.
Mm-hmm.
And then is shoved under the rug. That doesn't feel right to me.
Well, the wider community would like to know, but if I understood you, there's really a constitutional responsibility to complete the process. And there's no evidence that they are moving forward on that.
No evidence that I'm aware of as, a member who tries to pay attention and find out what's going on. I'm not aware of any progress on that at all. And in fact, the Unifor Constitution says that when the charges are laid, that the hearing will take place at the next meeting of the National Executive Board.
How many meetings, or has there been a meeting since?
Yes, there's been many meetings since.
Many.
Many. There were many meetings of the National Executive Board leading up to the convention and the election. And there's been a meeting of the new National Executive Board since the convention with the new president, Lana Payne. And that meeting, which took place in November, did not proceed with the hearing.
Well, how long can that kind of problem go on? Can they put that off forever? I mean, doesn't it have to be on the agenda?
I don't have the answer to that question. It should have been dealt with by now.
Somebody will have to talk to the lawyer. You know how many union leaders say, well, we'll talk to the lawyer about that. We get legal advice. Legal advice is clam up. It led to a reform of your union. I mean, in the sense that there was a convention where the old team, at least as it was known, did not prevail.
That's absolutely correct. I believe that it's led to some very positive developments. There were real elections at the convention rather than stage-managed ones. Jerry Dias's hand-picked successor was defeated very handily by Lana Payne at the convention with something close to two-thirds of the votes. And since then, there was a meeting of the Ontario Council of Unifor, which represents all of the locals in Ontario, which is basically about 50% of the union. Mm-hmm. And there were elections at that council meeting. And again, there were real elections, and a significant number of the nominees of the leadership were defeated.
Hmm.
It didn't have the same character as the elections in the U.S., where there's a clear reform group fighting for clearly identified issues. But at least there were real elections, and the preferred candidates, several of them were defeated. Didn't succeed. So that certainly shows a greater openness and at least possibility for challenging people.
There's been some shifting of chairs and new tables and new people sitting behind the chairs in your main office. Is that, I haven't seen, I hear that, and that's what I understand from labor people who tell me things, but I haven't seen any discussion of it in any media, including people who tend to write about the labor thing. Perhaps Sid Ryan has talked about it. I don't know. But the personnel are moving around.
There's definitely been some changes. And the new president, Lana Payne, has made a significant number of changes in the senior leadership of the staff, the people who are appointed by the president. But you're right, I haven't seen it commented on in any kind of news media. And I only hear dribs and drabs. You know, I hear, well, what happened to so-and-so? Well, we don't know that. They're not there anymore.
Yeah.
Where did they go? We're not sure.
The X's and Y's are out of there. You know, now we're speaking to Tony Leo, by the way, who is a labor activist and also a student in labor history. We left out something about this that really should concern our listeners, and that is that the allegation actually involving the cologne and the bag was that businessmen, or I don't know, one guy in the, we saw emails made public where they called rich people, one rich guy, asked union personnel to help sell the product, his product, which was a COVID-19 product to protect workers, to companies. And we have never, we hear about, I don't want to call him poor Jerry, but we know the name Jerry Dias. He was involved somehow, they claim. But we never heard the name of any of the guys who are called rich. There's I remember a Mr. A and a Mr. B. And what was going on there was, we call it unethical, but it could also be illegal. I mean, we were in a public health crisis. These products were something kind of important to keep track of. And anytime you have a crisis, you always want to be careful about people price gouging, exploiting a crisis to make more money. And that's why one would hope all the appropriate authorities were alert and vigilant. It doesn't seem to be the case, because I haven't seen any urgency. I haven't heard that the government says, you know, that's pretty bad, because, and I want you to talk about it, but my understanding is the product is supposed to be free.
Mm-hmm.
So how can you make money off something it's not supposed to be charging for? What was going on there, allegedly?
We don't know enough about what was going on. And to be frank, I don't believe that the leadership of Unifor has shown any inclination to try to find out more or to try to reveal more in the interest of the members about what was going on. Clearly, there was money being splashed around. The people who were putting up that money, the rich and powerful and influential people that they are, were doing that obviously because they were gaining a benefit from it.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't doing it just to, you know, for, you know.
Well, one assumes because there was something inside the bag.
Well, that's right. There was,
and so
there was money that they were putting up in return for something, you know, and it is, I think, a glaring failure on the part of the Unifor leadership that they have not pursued that part of the investigation and allowed the members of the union to know what was going on, who was involved, what companies were involved, who provided the money that was in the bag, which companies did Jerry and his associates twist arms to get them to buy the test kits. We don't know. And there doesn't seem identified. To be any effort to find out.
It was a test kit. That was the thing.
Yeah, they were test kits, we are told, yeah.
Now, and people should remember, the bag ended up in the hands of police, who
yes.
also have said nothing. It's been a long time. I know that they claim an ethically challenged federal government. I'm sure they're all honorable as can be and diligent. But it would be kind of interesting. You would think they would be interested.
They accepted the bag of money and said that they would conduct an investigation. And that's the last word we heard from the Toronto police.
Mm-hmm. But what, again, it would just strike me that the federal leadership, who some of whom actually knew Jerry personally and treasured him, I would say. And there was a Toronto Star who always called Jerry the kind of the basic labor leader of all of Canada. They surely they're disappointed and pained and would like to know more about what happened or should happen now. By the way, we have an opposition in Parliament. Shouldn't one of them stand up and say, you know, we were all fighting COVID and we had this affair. Could somebody tell us what happened? That would probably be, I think the public would be curious.
I agree. I think that the many workers would want to know. Many people who are active in the labor movement would like to know more.
Mm-hmm. No, it's there in front of you. I must say, I mean, for the union, I don't see how a celebrated labor name like this would be forever able to avoid further clarification from various quarters. But it is Canada, and a funny thing happens under this monarchy. Now we have a new king, so maybe we'll have a whole new ball game. Yeah. Now that a lot of the players are no longer on the field. Lastly, just to come back to a good news, what has this Mr. Fain, who is challenging now and looks like good chance to become the leader of UAW, what is he promising he's going to do?
Well, the platform of UAW Members United is no tears,
no tears
corruption.
System. He said no tear system?
No tears, no corruption, no concessions.
Mm.
So I think that sums it up pretty well.
Yeah, well, that T-I-E-R-S, you know, those would be tears of happiness. I mean, people have to understand that is a poisonous thing that has gotten into the labor movement and has damaged it badly everywhere, is the differentiation in wages between people doing the same job. It's the oldest headache organized labor has faced, because why should a person be a member of an outfit that allows that to happen to him or her? No, it's a great story. And so we, in the new year, in February, we will have the word. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, the ballots are put in the mail on January 12th. They have to be returned by February 28th, I believe. And then it'll take a couple of days after that to count them.
Oh, very good. Well, Tony Leo, Unifor 222, we thank you very much. I have a little item here that I think is appropriate from Bertolt Brecht. He was a good friend of the labor movement, I think you know. And he wrote a something that seems to me apropos, praise of learning. Learn the simplest things, for you, whose time has already come, it is never too late. Learn your ABCs. It is not enough, but learn them. Do not let it discourage you. Begin. You must know everything. You must take over the leadership. Learn, man in the asylum. Learn, woman in prison. Learn, wife in the kitchen. Learn, man of 60. Seek out the school, you who are homeless. Sharpen your wits, you who shiver. Hungry man, reach for the book. It is a weapon. You must take over the leadership. Don't be afraid of asking, brother. Don't be won over. See for yourself. What you don't know yourself, you don't know. Add up the reckoning. It's you who must pay it. Put your finger on each item. Ask, how did this get here? You must take over the leadership. This is Tater Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. We'll be back in just a bit. It's a Tater Report, CIUT, and we want to catch up with other matters that are important to our listeners and to us. We try to keep track of the stories which are should be on everybody's agenda, but are somehow discarded by the mainstream. There has been a report, rather dramatic one, that Joe Biden, President of the United States, put together a meeting with African leaders. Everything about it sounds wrong when you look at it closely, but the U.S. is very proud of it. You can go to various websites, see the whole story. But I'm very happy that the individual, a professor at Cal State, used to say Cal State, I think it's University of California, Stanislaw, known to the world as the Angry Arab, a brilliant scholar, he made a great find or notice of the New York Times headline reporting this meeting of Joe Biden, President Biden, and African leaders. And the headline was, well, that's good. I say that and then I have to hunt for the headline, but it is basically, the headline is, Biden bringing African leaders to White House. And as was pointed out by the angry Arab, that was, he said, they don't know how to hide the fact that they are colonialists and racist. If it was a French leader or British leader, it would be an invitation. But since these are leaders of African countries, he's bringing them. And it was a showpiece where Biden, stands in front of the African leaders and he tells them what the United States is going to do for Africa, which he actually means to Africa. It was impressive in the numbers that arrived there. It is a context in which it is described is, of course, that old losing an ugly proposition that U.S. leaders and the Canadians join them in this, as do the British and the French. They see everything in imperial terms, or more bluntly, imperialist terms. And the way the New York Times and the Toronto Star, Globe and Mail, and others reported on it was to say that facing fierce competition from China, the U.S. Rolls out a new plan. Basically, that's my homemade headline, but that describes it. They regard the reason they want to help Africa now, it turns out, is because they're facing fierce competition. What's wrong with that is, well, first of all, the whole thought that the reason you engage with other states, particularly the underdeveloped ones and former colonies, who are in poor economic shape because of colonialism, where they were robbed of their wealth and labor and humiliated for quite a long time. That's a bad idea, the approach that is taken. But when the subject of China is introduced, it's particularly dishonest because a terrible misrepresentation of truth, reality. The Chinese government and leadership has never said, and indeed they address it directly and explicitly, they say, we are not in competition with anybody. We are doing business, we trade, and we hope on good terms, which are accepted to both sides, the other the parties we deal with. And that is how we engage wherever it be in the world. They've been, by the way, engaged with Africa. China's been engaged with Africa for a long, long time. And I'll remind listeners of the Taylor Report that it was the African nations, the new African nations who were free, had freed themselves from colonialism, that insisted on and fought for the recognition of the People's Republic of China as the, and its government as the appropriate government for the Security Council representing China. At the time when they were under colonial authority, there was a country called the Republic of China run by Chiang Kai-shek, and he was on the island of Formosa, later Taiwan. And they were in league with the other, with the imperial powers, and they didn't lift a finger for decolonization. And whereas the People's Republic fought hard to assist the anti-colonial struggles of Africa. That's just a fact. And so for the United States to be talking about, oh, we're in fierce competition. Well, you know, it's like a bully in a bar who's looking for a fight and says, oh, you're my opponent. The other individual says, no, I'm not your opponent, and I'm not here to fight you. That's frankly what we're looking at. We're looking at a bully who says, oh, I'm having trouble with this guy, where the guy himself is not saying anything, going about his business, actually. So that meeting, very interesting, only, well, and who was there? A large number of African leaders were there. But they love to do things in a cheap and dirty way, at the insistence, by the way, of most African leaders. The concept was everybody will be invited. The African leaders don't like to get caught in these games where they say, well, 10 of us will go and the others will not be welcome. So they clearly, there was a struggle there where the U.S. made a pretense of respecting the wishes of African states. But they pulled a fast one on Zimbabwe. The president of Zimbabwe is Emmerson Emmerson Mnangagwa. 2 days before the meeting in Washington, his son, the son of Mnangagwa, was sanctioned by the United States and said he's not welcome, the son. So you know what's going to happen. The father and the Zimbabwean people are going to say, that's not the way to, you don't know how to be a host. You invite somebody, and then 2 days before you say, but you can't bring your son. I mean, or we don't like your son. We just want to make a point just before you would be here. So of course, and Emmerson Mnangagwa did not go. So, and there were other small stuff like that. By the way, something very peculiar happened. America is not too happy with Paul Kagame at the moment. They're still providing him money, and they're still providing him weapons, and they're still playing little games. But on the other hand, Secretary Blinken said something disparaging about Paul Kagame, among the reasons being that Paul Kagame is holding a Hollywood known individual, Paul Rusesabagina, who's been a guest on the Taylor Report, by the way, many times, who's now in prison in Rwanda. So, and he was a resident of the United States. He was kidnapped by the government of Rwanda and is in prison. So given the pressure from George Clooney and others, the president has said that they would like something done about that, and it offended Paul Kagame. So when they had their class photograph together, Mr. Kagame wasn't present. Incidentally, if we had good journalists, they would tell us, did Kagame refuse or did Americans say, we don't want you in the picture? I'd love to know the answer to that. I don't know the answer. Anyway, this is the Tater Report, and we want to talk about some other things. In Peru, there has been a right-wing coup. A right-wing coup. And Canada immediately made nice with the coup leaders, just the way Canada made nice with the coup leaders in Bolivia when they removed Mr. Morales, the first indigenous leader of Bolivia. Now in Peru, you also have Mr. Pedro Castillo, a indigenous leader. And everyone here, our media, immediately become experts on the life and details of Mrs. Pedro Castillo, about whom they actually know nothing. But because Human Rights Watch, which is in a U.S. Funded agency, it is, Human Rights Watch is a very handy weapon. U.S. uses it all the time. If you see them say something, you can pretty well decide it's probably the opposite. Do your homework. You heard me reading Bertolt Brecht. Do your own homework. But when you do, you'll discover the National Endowment for Democracy and Human Rights Watch are twin interventionist forces. They usually are kind of advance party. They go into a country and then they call on the Marines to come and save the country from whomever they've identified as the bad guy. They all have decided that Mr. Castillo had to go. The American U.S. ambassador congratulated the new president practically before the ink was dry on her signing the papers. My guess is that Peru is going to go through a upheaval, and it is in an upheaval. It's not being reported here very well. It's being mentioned because it is large, a major upheaval of the Peruvian people who know a stunt when they see one, and they don't seem to be willing to go along with it, which is more power to them. I want to point out that where our reporting breaks down in Canada and why you need to listen to the Tater Report, among others, you should also go to Telesur to get information on this one. But it's not being mentioned that the president of Mexico strongly supports the presidency of Castillo. He says this was a coup. He also said it is based on class, because Mr. Castillo is a union leader. Very few union leaders become presidents of countries. He's a union leader. He is also indigenous. And the rulers, white rulers of Peru, are rather like the old ruling group in Bolivia. There's a very strong line dividing the indigenous from the elite. And this is exactly what the president of Mexico said. And president of Mexico is a major figure in the world, certainly in this hemisphere, Spanish-speaking world as well. Highly regarded. He's far more popular a leader in Mexico than Justin Trudeau is. And far more popular than Joe Biden. And he says, no, it was a coup. And the people have to decide. You don't just, a right-wing Congress with using racial epithets and following it with armed violence against the people, that's not how you solve anything. He said this decision has to be put back in the hands of the people, which, by the way, Mr. Castillo is misrepresented as to what he was calling for. He was up against a right-wing Congress that was bent on destroying him. And eventually they created a circumstance where they could seize power. Now, wider, more importantly than that, I want you to know, I said at the beginning of the show, good hooray for Argentina. The government of Argentina also agrees that this was a coup. They recognize Castillo. That's Argentina. Other governments that recognize this as a coup are Venezuela and the ALBA group, and which is most progressive people understand that the ALBA is probably the, that was established by Hugo Chavez and carried on by Maduro, but ALBA is made up of many countries, including Cuba, Bolivia. Bolivia is another government, has not recognized this coup. They recognize Castillo. The government of Colombia, a major, one of the keystone countries of South America, Colombia. These countries together are saying that the Castillo was improperly removed, and they recognize Castillo as president. When you make a list of who on the other side, you're going to see some unsavory people. But the primary ones are the Five Eyes group, the North American representatives. And I want to remind you, our listeners, that Mexico is part of this major trade pact, whatever one might think of was a good idea, bad idea. It's Mexico, Canada, and the United States. Number three, numero tres, says this is a right-wing racist coup. Shouldn't the citizens of Canada be informed that our major partner, our pal, our somebody we respect, somebody we talk about, Mexico is a major, he doesn't agree at all with Justin Trudeau, Ms. Jolie, or Joe Biden. I mean, they meet anyhow. I mean, you know, they go, but he says on this, he's got a strong position. Why isn't that being talked about here? Isn't it important, the opinion of our partner, president of Mexico? And by the way, Argentina is a very important country. Colombia, major country. And up until about a year ago, Colombia was in the back pocket of the U.S. as a major right-wing-led country, but the people overwhelmingly chose to go a different direction. This is very important, and that's why we underline it on the Taylor Report. By the way, the slogan of the party, the Peru Libre, Free Peru Party, from which Mr. Castillo has emerged, they have the political differences, slogan, the motto of their party. The motto of their party is no more poor in a rich country. And Mr. Castillo was attempting in a parliamentary, what you call a bourgeois parliamentary system, to deliver to the poor of Peru and the indigenous. And believe me, that is hard work, and it's obviously dangerous work. So it is a coup. Support Argentina, Mexico, Colombia, Venezuela, ALBA, and the countries of the Caribbean who are members of ALBA. We're all in agreement. Castillo is the president, so don't let anybody tell you different. Taylor Report, CIUT. Now, our foreign minister, global affairs, minister of global affairs, they changed their names, I think, to throw us off, but is talking about how the government's going to guide Canadian businesses in dealing with the new Indo-Pacific strategy, which is, I say over and over again, it's a neologism. There is no Indo-Pacific. It's just a term to try to create division and hostility amongst the former colonized peoples of South Asia. Quoting Minister Jolie, Melanie Jolie, she says, the current moment demands more of Canada. Jolie said, part of that involves working in lockstep with Asian allies. We want to be as close to South Korea, to Japan, as we are to Germany, France, and Great Britain. That's our goal. Wasn't that fun to listen to that? She says, as we are to Germany, France, and Great Britain. She left somebody out, didn't she? She left out the United States, with whom we definitely are in lockstep. Maybe we could even say lockstep, and maybe add ball and chain. Lockstep. Now, this is a course that we've been talking about here. This is something everybody should be on guard about, and we should be raising hob about it, because out of this flows so many ugly things. One being an obvious danger of a conflict, direct conflict with China, and who would be allied with Germany and Japan. If you look it up, but if you check your history book, you'll find something interesting. Germany and Japan didn't help form the United Nations. The United Nations was formed by the states that defeated Germany and Japan. We ought to ask ourselves, how do we find ourselves in a situation with where we keep talking about Japan and Germany, with whom we're supposed to be in lockstep, which is not a nice image. It's like, that's marching and all that. When in fact, we formed the United Nations, a very healthy body, on the body of Germany, Japan. I hate to say it that, but they were fascists and Nazis. And you want to get healthy, you want to say, let us get back to the United Nations, where all states are treated equally and with respect. And let us keep our eye on those states which created fascism. And let us not encourage them to be arming and be looking for trouble in their neighborhoods, because both of them had a bad reputation. Those are things for everyone, I believe, to be thinking about as we approach the new year. And just to remind you, this is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. We have a nice song by a wonderful woman, Lotta Lenya, who is a close friend and co-worker of Bertolt Brecht. And so we're going to play that, and look forward to talking to you next week.
Gentlemen can watch while I'm scrubbing the floors, and I'm scrubbing the floors while you're gawking. And maybe once you tip me and it makes you feel swell, and I ride it waterfront in a ratty old hotel, and you never guess to who you are talking. You never guess to who you are talking. Suddenly one night there's a scream in the night, and you yell, what the hell could that have been? And you see me kinda grinning while I'm scrubbing, and you say, what the hell's she got to grin? And a ship, a black freighter, with a skull on its masthead, will be coming in. You gentlemen can say, hey girl, finish the floors, get upstairs, make the beds, earn your keep here. You toss me your tips and look out at the ships, but I'm counting your heads while I make up the beds. Nobody gonna sleep here tonight. None of you will sleep here. Then that night there's a bang in the night, and you yell, who is that kicking up around? And you see me kinda staring out the window, and you say, what's she got to stare at now? Then the ship, the black freighter, turns around in a shooting guns from the bow. And you gentlemen can wipe out that laugh from your face. Every building in town is a flat one. Your whole stinking place will be down to the ground. One of these cheap hotels standing up sailing sound. And you yell, why the hell's bear that one? And you yell, why the hell's bear that one? All the night through with the noise, and to do you wonder who's the person lives up.